Good morning, everyone. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, and I'm opening a session of the House Energy and Environment Committee. So we are going to go through a couple of public hearings today, and then we'll open up a work session on House Bill 4036. And just so everybody knows, we don't have the paperwork back on that bill, so we're not going to be, we'll just be discussing the amendment, but we're still going to, but we're going to need to hold it till Thursday in order to actually move it. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4034. Beth, can you give a little summary of the bill while Representative Helm moves down the podium?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4034 defines black carbon, requires the Oregon Global Warming Commission in its biennial report to include an estimate of the average annual emissions of black carbon in Oregon and an evaluation of the contribution of black carbon to global warming. There is a dash 3 amendment on OLIS, and I think I'll let Rep. Helm tell you the rest.
Thank you. Good morning, committee members. And for your record, my name is Ken Helm, representative for House District 34. What I'll do here real quick is go through the origins of the bill very quickly, talk about what the amendments do, and then just talk briefly about a couple letters of support from folks that couldn't be here today. The origins of this bill really came about after I read the most recent global warming report, which down in the corner of one of the important pages about emissions said, hey, there's this other stuff out there that's like a greenhouse gas and maybe just as harmful, but we don't know enough about it and we don't know how much there is and we'd like to study it more. And building off of that, several of us in the building and on the committee have had conversations about wildfire and the potential impacts from the emissions. So when the catastrophic wildfires that we had this past summer came to pass, I thought now is a great time to go ahead and focus on measuring black carbon that comes from these catastrophic wildfires and getting a recommendation from the Global Warming Commission about what we might do about it. And that is what this bill does. It started out a little bit more complicated in that I thought there might be a role for the Department of Land Conservation and Development to develop some wildfire risk management best planning practices as we went along. What I found in talking to stakeholders is that gave everybody a little bit of discomfort because we didn't know exactly what DLCD might be doing. And through those discussions, I determined that we don't have enough time in the short session to iron those out. So I'll continue to work on that and see who I can get interested in working those best planning practices up in the interim. Maybe something comes out of it. Maybe something doesn't. But for the time being, all we're doing is the tasks that are identified in Section 2 of the original bill, which is to estimate, have the Global Warming Commission estimate the annual average emission of black carbon in Oregon, and to have an evaluation of the contribution of black carbon in Oregon to global warming. Now, there are so far three amendments, a fourth from Rep. Johnson either is just in the hopper or soon will be. The first amendment simply clarified further what the definition of black carbon is for the purposes of this study. And it tightened it up from the original. The new definition would be black carbon means a strongly light absorbent component of the of particulate matter emitted during incomplete combustion of forest and rangeland, wood, shrubs, or grasses, or other carbon-bearing fuels. That definition was suggested by Angus Duncan, chair of the Global Warming Commission, and I'm happy to accommodate it. The amendment number 2 simply stripped out everything that discussed that role for DLCD. So Section 3 of the original bill is out, and everything related to it is out. That's what Amendment number 2 does. Amendment number 3 combines Amendment 1 and 2, and then Rep. Johnson had some clarifying amendments to certain other sections that we discussed yesterday afternoon, and I'm in agreement. So I think what the last step here is to combine amendments 3 and 4 into dash 5, and that's being worked on right now at LC, and we can come back to that on Thursday.
Okay.
I have there's a handful of folks here to talk about this bill, which I appreciate. Folks that couldn't be here today were representatives from the Sierra Club. I think you have a letter on your desk about that. And then a letter came in this morning, or was in my inbox, and I think it went on to our committee administrator from Sustainable Northwest. They're both in favor of doing the measurements and assessments that are discussed in the bill.
Thank you, Representative. All those are on OLIS.
Yes, yeah. Both on OLIS.
No,
I'm happy to answer.
The testimony, the letters of support.
Okay, got it.
I'm happy to answer any questions right now. Otherwise, we can hear from our supporters.
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Reardon.
Just one real quick one. Thank you, first of all, for all your work on this. I know it had my name on there, but you did all the work, so appreciate that. It says an estimate of the annual average emissions in an evaluation. Will we know at the end of this work the sources and how much different sources contribute to the amount of soot? So forest fires, wood stoves, other sources, where will we be able to go dig down into that?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, this study is fairly focused on the emissions from catastrophic wildfires, forest fires, and range fires. There are other sources of black carbon. Some of those are more complicated to get our arms around, such as diesel engines and wood stoves. I thought that was too complicated, again, for the short session. There's nothing wrong with having that information be available, but I think this is going to be a big piece of work because it's complicated to figure out how you want to measure the emissions from forest fires. That may be a big enough chunk for now, is my opinion.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Helm, just saying, going after wood stoves, you take on a huge issue in my district and around the state. And as an aside on the people who heat their homes with wood stoves, most often in the rural areas, but they're removing fuel from the forest that would burn and add to the forest fires should they start there. So they're actually doing a service by doing that, and wood actually is a carbon sequester, if you will. But all that aside, I'm just curious, how would you, I mean, if you solve this by preventing forest fires, that's great. You're going to be a billionaire. But how do you plan to use the data to, you know, what do you have envisioned for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, what I envision it to be is an information tool right now. One of the first questions we have to get settled is this a big deal? You know, how many metric tons of this stuff are we actually producing? We don't really have a measure. Black carbon is sat outside of our greenhouse gas analysis and outside of our climate policy the entire time we've had the policy. So it could be that we measure it and we say, you know, on an average annualized basis over some time period that makes sense, this isn't a big deal. But if it is, I think we need to start looking at it in tandem with the other sources of carbon that we already track through the Global Warming Commission reports, our industrial sector, our agriculture sector, transportation, et cetera, and see how we want to prioritize it. I don't have any preconceived notions about where this ought to go. I think it could go a lot of places and do a lot of good in thinking more carefully about how we treat our forests, but I don't have any particular methods or combinations of strategies in mind yet. I think much more discussion is needed there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I appreciate the efforts to try to focus on any area and try to achieve some sort of understanding of its contribution to problems we're trying to address in these discussions. The question would be, if we get this number, what are you going to compare it to? And of course, it brings me nicely to my bill, which is the carbon metric or the climate metrics bill. Is your thought that this will just be one piece of information, building on Representative Boone's remark, one piece of data, and now we have to go find a whole bunch more so we can actually compare it? Or is your thought that there'll be some value to this in isolation?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, my thoughts at this time are that it would be a piece of information that we'd stack up against what we already have and what we're already tracking. And then possibly to take a look at the measures that we could use to reduce black carbon. Say it stacks up in total annual amount of greenhouse gas type stuff against our industrial sector in total scope. Maybe at that point we look at, well, what are the tools that we have to deal with either one of those sectors? What are the easier and cheaper tools that we could use to address each one and have a good discussion about which direction we want to go at that point? What I don't know is whether black carbon is some low-hanging fruit or not in the overall scheme of carbon reduction. Maybe it is, but I think as you have observed, without the metrics, we don't know whether we can go after it or not.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a few questions, and thanks, Representative, for working with some of the concerns that have been brought to me about the original bill. Why the Global Warming Commission? I mean, Angus tells us all the time he's got no staff, no budget, no authority. Just prefacing his comments when he gets up here, rather than DEQ or EQC or people that kind of work on scientific stuff generally.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, basically my thought's not very complicated on that. It's because
looking for work.
It's it's already on the radar of the Global Warming Commission and had come through in the report. And I think that the Global Warming Commission already relies heavily on some of our state agencies for data and help, and I would expect that if they needed that, they would go that direction again.
Okay. Follow up, please.
Follow up.
In looking at the definition, I think that's the definition that's in the dash threes.
It should be, yes.
Black carbon. Incomplete combustion of forest and rangeland, wood, shrubs, or grasses, or other carbon-bearing fuels. And I can almost hear one of the concerns from some of our private timberland owners and so forth being, could this definition impact their abilities to manage their forest lands, i.e. slash piles and getting rid of debris and that kind of thing? And I just to clarify, I don't think that's your intent with this bill, but I just wonder if there's a way to fine-tune this a little bit more just to make sure that it's where the language couldn't potentially be construed to put limits on how they can do their renewable forest practices on privately held timberland.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, you're correct as to my intent. It's narrow. It is not to make decisions about how private forest land owners manage that that last bit of their process. In fact, prior to sending in my ideas for an LC on this issue, I talked extensively with Dylan Cruz from Sustainable Northwest, who does a lot of work with the forest collaboratives. And one of the interesting facts I didn't know very much about that came through that discussion was there is value in the slash. Mm-hmm. That very last bit of forest stuff out there that typically, in many cases, gets left because we don't have an economical way to get it out of the forest. And it's my hope that we wouldn't affect, you know, what the forest land owners can do with that, but maybe figure out a better way to utilize that stuff in an economic way. And I think Bill Cluding might talk a little bit about that today. Okay. The best case, of course, is if we can monetize it some way. It's there. It's unused. It's the last bit of stuff in the forest that might be used, and I'd like to see it used economically.
Follow up.
Could it be possible that emissions from Asia, coal-fired and or oil-burning emissions from Asia, could also fit into this black carbon definition?
Chair Peterson and Rep. Johnson, I don't think so. This is focused on Oregon. It might be the same kind of stuff.
That's my point, I guess.
Yeah. This is trying to get a hold of the state's contribution. And I know that that's difficult. You know, what if there's a forest fire in California, for example? I trust that the folks that will go off and figure this out will see that we can't include fire emissions from California in our estimate. It has to be somehow related to the land area of Oregon.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you all.
So next up, we have Angus Duncan, Heath Curtis, and Angela Crowley.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thank you. Nice to see you all again to talk about something altogether different here. My name is Angus Duncan. I chair the Oregon Global Warming Commission. We do have a concern about black carbon, which is often characterized as the seventh of six greenhouse gases that we have to deal with. We don't know a great deal about it, but we do know that there's a very clear connection between it and global warming forcing and increased temperatures, you know, on the surface of the globe. And we know that a lot of black carbon comes out of things like forest fires. So we are going to be looking at this anyway. Certainly in cooperation with the Oregon Department of Forestry and DEQ, and in response to Representative Johnson's quite accurate question. Number one, I think our commission, for all of its limitations, punches a little bit above its weight. And this is an instance where, we have decided we're going to be looking actually at black carbon in the context of a broader look at forestry practices and the relationship between the forests and our greenhouse gases. And that's the reason that that's an important thing, a big deal, is that we expect that look will inform a lot of issues that we are collectively concerned about. One clearly is fuel loading in the forests and the contribution of that fuel loading to more extensive and more severe fires than are consistent with ecological function. Sequestration and trying to measure the carbon that we hold in the forest and how we optimize that in connection with other uses of the forest, in connection with things like forest and watershed health, and in connection with the larger question of forest biomass and whether there's the potential for using the excess fuel, the clearings on private forest lands, a whole series of fuel options to substitute that fuel for fossil fuels, and whether when we do the carbon accounting, we can conclude that doing those things, has no net increase on emissions out of the forest, and ideally results in lower emissions from the forest. And in fact, I'm headed out to John Day tomorrow with a different hat on as a collaborator in a potential forest biomass to energy project that we're looking at out there. As I informed Representative Helm, I had two issues with his original bill, the definition of black carbon, and the substitution that he has provided, which I simply drew from EPA, is an accurate characterization of black carbon. And I wanted to make sure that we distinguish between the kinds of fires that we are deeply concerned about that have a very broad extent, that are very severe, that are very destructive of forest and watershed health, and we distinguish those from the normal role of fire in ecosystem management and ecosystem function in our forests. Happy to answer questions on this, but I am pleased to be here in support of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Megan Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Angela Crowley Cook with Oregon Environmental Council. And OEC supports this bill with a dash three amendments. We're still evaluating the other amendments and hope to have an answer on those soon. But we really appreciate the effort, the bipartisan effort on this bill, spearheaded by Representative Helm, to evaluate black carbon, because black carbon is not only a serious contributor to climate change, but also contributes to harmful air quality, which is very dangerous and toxic. So as was previously mentioned, black carbon comes from wildfires, but also from transportation and wood smoke. And we hope to evaluate all of these sources at some point. And I just want to point out one thing in particular, reason why black carbon is really important for us to evaluate here in Oregon, and that's its impact on snowpack. When the black carbon particles fall on snow, they absorb heat, which contributes to the melting of snow and ice. And because snowpack is so important for our water supply here in Oregon, I think it's especially critical that we're taking this hard look at black carbon and how it contributes to climate change. So we support the bill, and thank you very much.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. I'm glad I showed up for the testimony this morning. I think that there may be some conflict between the dash three and dash four amendments. The dash three amendments speak to fires that are inconsistent with historical ecological functions. I would suggest to you that fires that are consistent with historical ecological functions may still be contributing black carbon in material amounts. That is to say, there may very well be a good reason to mitigate the black carbon emissions from those fires. Conversely, there are legitimate land management practices, including prescribed burns in forests and fires on prescribed burning on rangeland that also emit black carbon, but that do so for a very good reason. That is to say, usually the alternatives are ecologically worse. I think that the definition suggested by the Dash 3 amendments would focus unnecessarily on what's ecologically natural, but not necessarily what's ecologically best. So from that perspective, the Dash 4 amendments, which have been prepared, focus on unplanned fires, much like the original bill was styled. And it would direct the Global Warming Commission to focus on black carbon emissions from unplanned fires, that is, those that landowners are not using to serve other valuable purposes. So for that purpose, we would very much support the Dash 4 amendments. I would very much not support the Dash 3 amendments. And were it appropriately amended, we think that this bill actually raises a valuable issue. That is to say that there's often a very casual and cavalier attitude around wildfire in Oregon, largely originating on federal land. And we think that there are very good public reasons why those fires should be suppressed to the degree that they can. And for that reason, I think that we're in support of the general thrust of the bill that the representative has put forward, but we're very apprehensive about the amendment suggested by the Dash 3.
Thank you. And we don't have the Dash 4 available.
I don't think so.
Okay.
All
right. Do you want to just wait until we get the last one, the Dash 5, to put the final thing up? Okay. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I agree that we should have a differentiation between unplanned and planned forest and rangeland fire, but I'm wondering if it would be useful to track both of them you know, as far as black carbon emissions, and, you know, separately, I'm just wondering what the thoughts are about that. And is that going to be included in the Dash 4?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby. From my perspective, there are some very vocal proponents of eliminating climate change emissions from whatever source at whatever cost. You'll have to forgive me if I'm not interested in painting that bullseye on field burning in agricultural practices or slash burning in forestry. I think that there are a number of very legitimate activities, including diesel truck emissions, including wood stoves that emit particulates as well. If this is a conversation that this body wants to dive into, I would suggest to you that it threatens to be very contentious. One way, I think, to avoid that contention would be to restrict this analysis to unplanned wildfires, which I think most people are in support of suppressing, and I think that this would give you further cause to do so.
Madam Chair, can I respond to the question also? So I guess number one, it's absurd to suggest that we shouldn't follow the trail of greenhouse gases wherever it leads us, and certainly it's going to lead us to looking at a lot of the activity, a lot of our day-to-day and a lot of our economic activities. You know, House Bill 4036 is looking at an even more central question of sources of greenhouse gases, but we are looking at it because we need to figure out how to manage these. We also need to figure out how to manage them, you know, in balance with managing, in this case, our forests. And when I said we're looking as a commission at greenhouse gases in forests, we're going to be looking at that balance between the uses of the forests, the ecological forest and watershed health issues, and the sources of black carbon. I can't tell you exactly where that is going to lead, but it ought to lead to at least a more informed set of choices for a committee like this. And, you know, those choices are going to come back to you. I assume that, and this is consistent with many of the representations Representative Benz has made, I assume that we want more information, if it's good information, rather than less. We ought to, and I expect our commission will be looking at both planned and unplanned fires, because both of them are sources of black carbon. You know, we may well resolve that there are some sources of black carbon that we need to protect. And if that's the case, then we have to push down harder on other sources of black carbon. Same with carbon dioxide, same with methane.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this issue, I know we don't have the Dash 4s in front of us, but Representative Johnson brought them to me yesterday, and we had a good discussion about them. I do not think that the Dash 4s, when we see them on Thursday in some form, foreclose any type of analysis, and they don't lock us into any sort of management practice in the future. And I don't want this discussion to get of, shall we look into measuring this stuff, to get sidelined about what might happen with the data in the future. I think that's, we're getting way ahead of ourselves to do that. So we've got a great idea in hand here. You know, let's see what the numbers say before we decide what we're going to do about them.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Angus, I guess I just want to caution you that if this bill passes, that legislative intent should be the governing practice here, not agency wishes. And some of your statements, I think, are very concerning to some people in this room about working to begin to delineate and make recommendations about agricultural practices, land use practices, forest practices that are clearly in place and working very well. So there's going to be a narrow window here of application for you all, and I just really want to caution you about expanding that based on your own wishes and desires.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, so I appreciate that. And whatever legislation the committee and the legislature approves is the legislation, you know, we will observe. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So thank you very much. And it sounds like we're going to have another amendment, and we'll post that as soon as it's available. Okay. Thank you. Next up, we have Bill Cluding and Ricky Seidwin.
Go ahead and start.
Yeah, thank you.
Ricky Seguin. I work as the director of Environment Oregon. We are a statewide citizen-based environmental advocacy organization representing over 40,000 Oregonians across the state. Short and sweet, we're supporting this bill. Thanks very much to Representative Helm for the hard work on this and for listening to the input from a whole host of stakeholders. I think the point he just made, sort of in reference to one of the last questions, is important. All this is doing is looking into exactly what is the contribution of black carbon. I think the Global Warming Commission is the right body to be doing this for the reasons Angus already said. They're already looking into this. They're already consulting with other agencies who have a lot of the data. And as the state is making more and more decisions about how to both prepare for and defend against global warming, how to tackle it, the best thing we can do is have more information on the table. So we support this bill and are looking forward to seeing the other amendments. At this point, we've only seen the dash threes. Thanks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. First, let me appreciate and thanks Representative Helm and the sponsors of this bill, 4034. In my opinion, this bill has been, it should have come forward years ago. The information that's handed out here, I've been showing this in this body for almost 9 years. And ironically, the EPA in 2002 knew that there was a problem. So they commissioned a study. I won't go through all the names of the groups that put this study together. But it kind of went on the shelf and just laid there, and it shouldn't have. One point that came out right off the bat was 80% of the smoke, particulate matter, they call it, PM, 90% of this can go into the human lung. We had testimony in some of the other bills in here about all the health problems because of the air quality. Looking down through this, the way we put this together, I'll use the Biscuit Fire for an example. 2002, one of the worst fires we've had, 500,000 acres. When you burn wood in a forest fire, one ton of wood burnt produces 25 to 40 pounds of PM, particulate matter. I use 20 pounds, but still, that means that fire alone put out 3 million pounds of matter that people can breathe into their lungs, 3 million tons. In 2007, wildfires scorched hundreds of thousands of acres in Oregon, producing an estimated 4.5 million pounds of PM. EPA, at that same time period, put out a statement saying nationally, forest fires created 562 million tons of carbon. In addition, 2007, greenhouse gas emissions, principally CO2 from forest fires in Oregon, resulted in 56 teragram. Now, when I read that word, I had to get the dictionary out to figure out what teragram was. But if you see there, it says teragram equals 1.1 million tons of emissions. And this is from Oregon. What that amounts to, that 1 year of driving 11 million cars 24 hours a day, 365 days in the year, one fire. That was more than all the other emissions in this state. That one fire was more than all the other emissions, automobiles, you name it. When you glance down to the last paragraph, what other emissions are in smoke from forest fires? Carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, ammonium, volatile organic compounds, formaldehyde, methanol, and airborne lead and mercury. I'm, like I remind the committee, Madam Chair, I've been showing this in this building for a long time, and again, I appreciate Representative Helm and the sponsors stepping forward finally. What this is going to take, Oregon can't do it alone. We need all the Western states involved. And you heard it once, and I'm going to say that really, the federal government is not helping us at all on this. You can look at the private forest fires from the private landowners and the state, and they're immediately in there salvaging what they can, working on the soil to stabilize it, and planting new trees. I can show you fires in the federal forests that are 8, 9 years old, and they haven't been touched yet. Not touched. I'm not counting the wilderness area. You know, by federal law, you can't even hardly walk in them, let alone fight a fire. But your federal fires from federal land are almost untouched. I'll state that forest fires is one of Oregon's major air pollution problems. We had over 1,000 fires in Oregon last year alone. Again, the state and private people are in there repairing those fires. If I don't think I have to remind people that people that drive in Portland without their headlights during the day, they had to drive with their headlights on from the smoke from Eastern Oregon. All down I-5, Eugene, Medford, they had to drive with their headlights on from the fires in Southern Oregon. And coming in from Northern California. That's why I say we need all the states involved in this. I think it's time this is done. You notice I wear my Jobs pen every day. We need to get into these federal forests and do the proper management. When that, what's left after a fire, that's not the end of the carbon emission. When that tree rots for the time period, very little goes into the soil. You almost have to bury that to trap that carbon. That carbon leaks into the air continually. And we're not even planting, going in there and planting new trees to help balance that factor. Again, thank you, Representative Helm. Committee, I think this has to be more than Oregon. I think it's time, Oregon. I'm glad Oregon's stepping forward. You don't see this in other states, but I think it's time. I think our governor has to get involved. My organization is going to benefit It's going to benefit rural Oregon if we can properly maintain and manage our forests. We can't stop all the fires, but I guarantee you, we can cut the fires in half. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you both very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4034 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4125. Beth, can you give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4125 would direct the Oregon Health Authority to analyze the results of tests of groundwater from wells and supply water for domestic purposes. We don't yet have a fiscal revenue impact statement. There is both a dash one and dash two amendment on OLIS, and there's a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. And I believe we have Representative Lively here to talk about this bill. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is John Lively. I'm state representative from District 12, which is the city of Springfield. College, I have to tell you that I have a preference. I'd rather sit on that side than sit out here and look. But, you know, I'll go with it anyway since I'm not on this particular committee. So I'm here today to ask for your support for House Bill 4125. This bill is about public health and safety as it relates to contaminated or potentially contaminated drinking water. Recent high-profile public water system contamination issues, one in the community with water provided from a river and the other from wells, reinforce the risk of health problems from contaminated drinking water. More than 70% of Oregonians get some of their drinking water from wells, and 23% of Oregonians rely on privately owned wells as their primary source of water. In the city of Springfield, all of our water comes from wells, and I'm fortunate I live in a community that's large enough to have the treatment systems and the tests and things on an ongoing basis to make sure that that water is safe. But one of the things the community had to do several years ago was actually do overlays throughout our community of where the water is flowing that comes into the wells to ensure that we didn't build over top or do things on top of that flows, which can cause contamination. So certain types of industrial uses and things were restricted to certain zones in order to ensure we didn't contaminate our own well water, let alone what may come in from outside sources. My parents lived in rural Lane County for quite a few years and had a septic tank and a well. And there was a point after they'd lived there quite a few years, never thought about testing their water, that the taste wasn't great and my parents' health wasn't great, but they never believed it was the well. Once the well was tested, they found out two things. One, they were contaminating their own well with their septic tank that was failing. They lived in an area where the clay and stuff made the flow of water pretty impossible. And the second thing was, now remember, they lived in rural Lane County. They didn't live in a community. Their neighbor had an auto body shop on his property, which he was allowed to have, but he was also, with the waste and stuff that he put out on the ground from his auto body shop, was contaminating their wells. And so it took them quite a while both to figure out what was in there. And fortunately, they were in a position they could afford to put in a filtration and treatment system in order to continue their well. So that's one example. Oregonians need to know whether the water they are drinking is safe so that they can act and protect their families. So House Bill 4125 directs OHA to use real estate transaction well data to target voluntary education and outreach areas to where contamination threats are the greatest. So first is that these contamination threats are identified to make sure there's education and outreach to people that live in those areas that may be impacted. So if they haven't had their wells tested, they can do so. It provides funding to help rental property and low-income property owners repair drinking water wells and install water quality treatment systems. Provides funding for county health departments and other local organizations to provide voluntary well testing programs and public education, and requires landlords to provide recent test results for arsenic, bacteria, and nitrate to new tenants and to retest drinking water as stated. While this bill is a small step, and I emphasize it, it's a small step, and I think that's what we mostly get to do in the legislature, it is an important one to address a growing risk of contaminated drinking water and the short and long-term impacts upon a person's health. One of the things we learn over time, and I continue to learn over time, and serving on the health care committee, you see, is the long-term impacts of contamination, whether it's in water or other things, but what it has upon our bodies. And sometimes we're talking about years before these impacts show up. From my standpoint, the more we can do to early identify what those risks might be and to help address those risks, the better off we will all be. So I'm here to ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rep. Lively.
Certainly.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next, we're going to have Cindy Roberts, Angela Crowley Cook, and Chrissy Lucas. Any one of you can start. Just don't forget to state your name for the record.
My name is Chrissy Lucas, and I am a program assistant for Oregon State University, and I am the only groundwater protection educator that they have on staff. Of course, the university does not have an official position on the bill, but I am here in support of it.
Thank you.
Oh, look, my presentation's up. Okay. Sorry. You'd think for an educator I would not be quite so nervous. So I submitted a written story of a local woman that I had interacted with when I very first started about 9 years ago. And she had come into a nitrate screening clinic that we had and a rural living basics class where we basically just talk about living with your well and living with your septic tank, because very commonly we have folks calling our office, and I work in Lynn, Benton, and Lane County, that say, oh, my water smells funny. Most of the things that you can smell or see in your water are not going to hurt you. It's the things you cannot see or taste. And frequently I'll say, oh, well, you know, I've had it tested, but they'll be like, oh no, you know, we're like on city water. And I'm like, you live 20 miles out of town. Have you ever paid a water bill? And I wish it was an uncommon question that I had to ask, but folks that are moving into a rural property that have never lived on a rural property before just don't know. While we know that 90% of our rural population is dependent upon groundwater, that is a combined number of both small public water systems as well, that 23% are just dependent upon domestic wells. The scary part is that third number down, 350,000 active wells, and if you look at the numbers that are being tested every year, it's probably less than 10,000 for sure. And if you look at real estate transaction data and also well testing data across the state, they're pretty much the exact same. So folks are only getting their water tested most of the time when their real estate is changing hands. They're not doing it just for the general health. One of the big contaminators that we have, or potential contaminants, is nitrate. Very common in our agriculture areas. It is the main component of fertilizer. It's also in everybody's septic system. So we are all contributors of nitrate. At higher levels, which could be over 7 parts per million, 10 parts per million, there's not super clear data on that. You can see a lot of issues with headaches, dizziness. The reason I didn't go to vet school, because of really big words like that. And it can actually, basically what nitrate does in your body is it interferes with your blood's ability to absorb oxygen. So for anybody, this is an important matter, whether you're an elderly person that has some sort of heart condition or anything where you really need to maximize the amount of oxygen in your blood. Small children, especially who they are maybe toddlers who are drinking a lot of formula that's made with this water, there's going to be a higher absorption rate of that nitrate and less ability for them to carry oxygen in their blood, which is never good. So this is a map of the Southern Willamette Valley area, which is where I primarily work. There's very high levels of nitrate, so much so that DEQ came in and helped the communities declare a voluntary groundwater management area. And there are monitoring wells throughout this area where they actually will be pulling samples every quarter. Some folks are actually testing monthly, and it is not uncommon to find wells that are pulling between 25 and 30 parts per million of nitrate in the water, which is three times the EPA level for a public water system to distribute. So we did a focus group a couple years ago just to see where folks were at. So we did a commercial agriculture one just to talk to farmers, because that is a huge portion of use in our area. And they really understood the water cycle and how their land practices were affecting groundwater. and then we pulled in some rural residents, and they really did not understand groundwater at all. They didn't understand how to take care of their well. Most had treatment systems on their property, especially several folks that had rented. They had these great treatment systems, and they had no idea what the treatment system was for. They thought it was to take care of hydrogen sulfide, that smell, or an iron issues, but they had reverse osmosis systems that there had been installed to deal with nitrate. And every one of them said as long as the water tasted good, they just assumed that it was safe. And also indicated that they just were unsure how they should test, where they should test, how often they should test. And renters said that they were really scared to even ask their landlords to test, because they didn't feel that it would be a need that was addressed. So the Domestic Well Safety Program through Oregon Health Authority put together real estate transaction data for nitrate, positives, negatives, everything that popped up. From 1989 to 2015, these are not complete results for sure. Not all real estate transactions for a while in this were actually reported correctly. But you can see there's a high level of over 10 parts per million, all of the orange that is listed. And these are, of course, in a, you know, you see clustered areas. In our Southern Willamette Valley groundwater management area, in Lynn Benton, Lane County, you see lots of positives, but you also see them over in northern Malheur, which also has another declared groundwater management area, and up in the lower Umatilla, which has a groundwater management area as well. Arsenic is the other one of the other ones that we would really like to see testing for. It has recently, in the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, been added to real estate transactions. And in this, we've actually found areas that we assumed didn't have arsenic because we'd never looked for it. And with this real estate transaction data, we are seeing arsenic in areas we never expected to see it based upon what we knew about the geology. Over a long period of time, it can definitely be associated with many cancers. And this is all data that Molly Kyle from OSU has provided to me as far as premature birth weight. That is what she primarily studies, is arsenic. that was that. So arsenic is pretty commonly found in groundwater, and it is also odorless and colorless. So just like nitrate, it's not something we're going to see. And as she focused in on both the Willamette Valley and some eastern Oregon areas, you can see that we really popped up a very high level of arsenic, up to 50 parts per billion, which would be five times the EPA's limit if we were using that results. And again, the real estate transaction data, you can see there's a large area and lots of wells that are popping up. And then the third thing is coliform bacteria. And anytime you put a hole in the ground, no matter where you are in any county, you are exposing the groundwater to some sort of surface contamination. So there is potential for coliform bacteria to get into the well. Also then we, you know, many times we'll have animals on our rural residential properties. Wildlife flies over. E. coli and coliform can come from anywhere. So it's just really a surface to groundwater interaction that's going on. And it can also be found in failing septic systems. So if your septic system is failing, hasn't been pumped recently, or is just not working appropriately, we have that potential for coliform bacteria, the most harmful being E. coli, to get into your groundwater supply. And if you're not testing for it and you're getting sick over and over and over again, you know, we're putting a strain on you, and it could be something that's very easily remedied by just testing for it and then treating for it if you know you have it. And in Benton County specifically, they did a program where they tested 90 wells. They had funding to do 90 wells, and they went out and they actually tagged the wells. They did a well maintenance check with the homeowners and found that about several of their wells, at least 20% of that, were not even constructed appropriately. So they needed to do some changes with construction just to get them up to the current code. And they also tested for arsenic and nitrate. So just in general, we would really like to see more testing occurring, or access to testing or education, just so the public is aware that this is really out there. It's a big issue. And if you're not testing and you're not looking for it, you're never going to find it. But you also could be harming yourself and your family.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Angela Crowley-Cook. Again, I'm here with Oregon Environmental Council. And I want to thank Representative Lively for bringing this bill forward. You may remember that this bill came before this committee last session, and the committee unanimously passed two parts of the bill last session, so we're back. This session and in this fall, I sat down with Cindy and with others in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition to work on an agreement for the landlord testing piece of the bill. So to describe again, there's three parts to the bill. The first is directing the Oregon Health Authority to do more education, outreach, and testing. And I think, as we heard from Chrissy, education is really needed. And that was one of the main drivers of this bill. The second part of the bill is a new revolving loan fund to help low-income homeowners and any income level landlords to have treatment systems or to do well repair if they've had a construction problem. And then the third piece that I'll go into a little more detail on is the agreement about the new landlord testing requirement and the disclosure to tenants. So the Oregon Health Authority recommends that for all domestic well owners, the guidelines are a minimum of a one-time arsenic test and then annual tests for nitrate and bacteria. So in our discussions over the fall, the landlords had some concern about costs. And so the agreement we worked out was that the landlords, well, and I should mention before I continue, this new requirement only applies to landlords who have fewer than 10 people on a well or wells with four or fewer connections. If you have over 10 people and four connections, you're already regulated and required to test quarterly. So this is just for that small group of landlords that are not currently required to test. So for those folks, the agreement we came up with was annual testing, one-time testing for arsenic in the life of the well, annual testing for bacteria and nitrate, unless for 3 years in a row, if the landlord has a clean test, so no presence of any bacteria or nitrate, they could move to a five-year testing schedule. So to make things a little easier for the landlord, but still make sure that the tenants are receiving good results, test results of what their water quality is. Also in the bill, there's $15,000 appropriated to that Safe Groundwater Fund, which can be used for the low-income homeowners and landlords to fix their wells or to get a treatment system. So I can go into a lot more specifics, but I'll just stop there and see if folks have questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon. We have about 1,800 members, 81% of whom own 10 units or fewer, so I'm really representing the mom-and-pop landlords, I like to say. So as you've heard, this bill, as it's supposed to be amended, requires landlords to do annual testing, requires them to collect the sample, requires them to send it in, requires them to get a report to a tenant, report to prospective tenants, report to the Oregon Health Authority, pay for the testing, and pay penalties for failing to test. And we support it. Why? Because we are responsible for habitability. And my folks, if, knowing that the statute requires them to maintain a habitable unit, includes the drinkable water. And for them, this is a tool. They have no way of knowing if they're supplying the drinkable water unless they test. Our only pushback was on how often to test. And for us, we did some research, and I found that other municipalities and states that require this testing, it's usually about every 5 years. Some of them were every 3 years. Actually, there were very few municipalities and states who required this testing. So we're ahead of a lot of folks, but it's a good thing to be ahead on. So we came to this agreement that we would test for 3 years, and if you had a clean test for 3 years, then you didn't have to test again for five. We think this is fair. Landlords sat down with Angela, and she worked very hard on this with us. We sat down with Angela, and there's three major landlord groups in Oregon. Two of us support it. One of us is neutral. And so we urge you to pass this bill that Angela worked so hard on, and we thank Representative Lively for making her work so hard on it.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if it's a question for you guys or Representative Lively, but the delineation is 10 units or 10 persons to put this into the category. Is that, are we within the landlord lingo, are we talking about 10 rental units or 10 occupants of rental units?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe it's occupants, and the number above that is already taken care of, as Angela explained, so.
Another follow-up I'll bring up, too. I know there's some angst among some of the ag community about who provide housing for workers, but they don't have a landlord-tenant relationship. Generally, it's just housing they make available to workers and so forth as they pass through. And I don't know if Farm Bureau's in the room or not to make a comment on this.
They're going to be taking it.
But that was one of the concerns about if they would be brought into this automatically. So I probably don't have a comment on that, but hopefully Farm Bureau can clarify that, because we don't want to create any other issues where there isn't really a landlord-tenant type relationship. And I think that's exactly what you're talking to, though.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that was something that we looked into and had a conversation with Legislative Council. Farmworker housing is already exempt from landlord-tenant law, and this the amendment, and that's the dash one I forgot to mention, it already, since it's putting this new requirement in the Oregon statute in Chapter 90 where landlord-tenant law is, since farmworker housing is already exempt from that, it's also exempt from this new requirement.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a question for Christina. Did you test for any in your testing, did any of it, are they for, they cause breast cancer? Any of those things you tested for?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I did not. I believe in the arsenic testing. In the research, it can contribute to all cancers. Nitrate has not been examined that thoroughly because we are in a very, Oregon is very unique where we have a very high level of nitrate in areas, but we haven't spent the money in to do the complete health research. It's suspected, but you can be suspected in a lot of things and not long-term know.
And just a quick follow-up. Is the arsenic then, it seemed to be, I'm trying to look up the I can't get the slide with the map on it, but where it's found, are there certain areas, you know, where it seems to be found that there are conditions where you're likely to find it because of whatever? So that would cause you to test more there or be concerned about those areas. I know that's not a clear question. I don't know what they had in this today, but it's not happening.
Absolutely. Like, there are definitely folks that I have seen that have conditions, and they will, working with their physicians, try and see if maybe it's a contributing factor. But long term, it's not my area of specialty. Arsenic is not. Nitrate is more my
thing. Representative Rudin.
This question actually may be for Representative Lively, but let me throw it out there. So it has to do with the timing of the test around a real estate transaction. So it looks, if I'm reading this correctly, somebody may have made a purchase and not get the test results for a few months later. so they could inherit a problem and with a well. So is that, am I reading that correctly? And so, is there a way to get the test results sooner?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon. There's one, it's already an existing law that when you sell your home, you need to test your wells and share the results with the buyer, I believe, as the transaction is taking place. So that's actually not covered in this bill. In terms of the new landlord testing requirement, what's written in the Dash 1 amendment is that for new tenants, you have to provide the test results that are current at the time of the new lease. And for existing tenants, so the testing requirement starts on March 1st of 2017, and that's when the health authority believes that they'll be finished rulemaking for the new loan fund. And so for existing tenants, the landlords have 90 days from March 1st, 2017 to provide that well test. That was part of our agreement.
The purchasers will have the information provided.
Well, so if it's a landlord-tenant relationship,
buying the property.
So that's existing law, and that you get that result at the time that you purchase the house.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holby.
Thank you, and maybe Representative Lively is the one to answer that question. To follow up with Representative Reardon's question, I don't know that I heard an answer. What happens, because part of this bill says if the seller doesn't comply with providing those test results, it doesn't invalidate the conveyance. And so in that particular case, the buyer didn't get the test results in time to change his mind on the conveyance and is now, I assume, inheriting the cost of any kind of fix-it program that they may be required to do through state agencies.
So, Representative Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey. So that's a piece of existing law that's just mentioned in the bill, and I believe the buyer gets the results before the purchase is final. Chrissy's nodding. That's good. But that nothing in this bill changes existing law in that area.
So the scope of this is really just in the renter situation. It doesn't do anything to change the existing statute for purchasing a home.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you,
Chair,
for clarifying that. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much. Next up, I have John Huddle, Peggy Lynch, and Jerry Schmidt. Welcome. Go ahead and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I represent the Deschutes County Citizens Action Group. It's a group that's been advocates for groundwater protection and consumer protection in the South Deschutes, North Klamath areas of what we call the Lapine Basin.
Can you please state your name for the record?
It's John Huddle.
Thank you.
Sorry. We feel the bill is just not ready yet. It's got a lot of great ideas. We really support the education piece. In our experience, we've been the only ones doing any education there. It kind of made me jealous to hear of all the research that's been done over in this valley, because we pushed for funding for research for the OSU Institute of Water and Watersheds, and we've been stymied all along because we want good research. One of the problems that we have is the assumption that real estate well test data is, makes a good scientific measure. It really doesn't, because by the time, in our experience, I've worked with the data, I've got a minor in research methodology and in design in my doctorate, and I've taught research courses. The problem with the data is, first of all, it's dirty data. It's in there now. You'll find duplicate entries, same date, same time, same well. They're transposed values. You have to strip those out. So there's a lot of data that's not usable. A lot of data is not reported. Our conversation, I don't know if they've ever caught up with the backlog because it was shifted from agency to agency, is just a lot of data sitting there that's really not reliable. And that's one of the first problems. So we have some concerns about using this data for management areas, determined for policy. We think it's a good springboard to go forward and look at okay, we need to do research here. We need to figure out what's going on scientifically before you determine management areas. But for education purposes, we don't really object to that. We think that's a great idea. In fact, we'd like to see OSU extension services and see some things funded where there's actually educating people on how to take care of their wells and their septic systems. And we don't see that at all. One of the problems that we encounter out there is the well age, the seal, the depth, the driller skill. Sometimes their earlier wells have been put in by the homeowner, I assume following Mother Earth news or something. One well that I talked to the owner was at stovepipe casing. The range there is going to run from 6 feet deep to 1,300 feet. Central Oregon in that high desert is very different from what you would see in the valley in terms of where you go for water. You know, you really shouldn't be going for first water. The driller should be going for second or subsequent water. Lapine State Park, I think they had to go down to the third level because the second was, you know, had gases from volcanic residue or whatever down there. It wasn't usable. So you got all of those things. We think it's great to use this data as an education tool to tell people, okay, this is what you've got to do. You maybe need to look at your well. Your well might be corroded because they do age and wear out. But it's so unreliable. To the piece that we really object to is Section 2, Subsection 3, where it talks about DEQ taking this data, and they've got a range of things that they could do policy-wise. We want the focus on education and identify for education, then identify for research. And we really want to see the OSU Institute of Water and Watersheds involved because they do the research, and we want that. We want that stuff funded. We want to know what's there and address it scientifically, not from wells that have such huge variability that you can't really determine just what it is. Was it one well I looked at was probably in a basement under a pump shed because it was a high nitrates, but it was a 2-inch diameter well, so it couldn't have a submersible pump. Did he have fertilizer above it? It looked like it was close to his drain field. It wasn't where it was supposed to be. You got all sorts of variables in there, and we want to, you know, look at this from a point of education. Logically look at these wells to determine if there's some, you know, remediation needs to go on through that education. But don't allow it to become a management tool to declare management areas, because it's not reliable for that. And, you know, where we live, you won't get buy-in from the communities if you just have an uproar. There was one there already where they were going to force everybody to put an alternative treatment technology septic systems in, and that was overturned by referendum. It was just affecting the South Deschutes County, but the entire county voted to overturn it. So there's a lot of pushback from that. So focus on the things that I think are really important that you can come out of a water well test. One is education, and two is logically are the things that could be done to safeguard water, such as putting in a well that's the adequate depth with the right casing, maintaining that well, you know, common sense stuff. And of course, the septic systems, make sure that they're pumped and that, which doesn't, you know, isn't addressed from this. The other part that gives us some concern, some angst, is the financial assistance. I think the authors of the bill are a little optimistic about what it costs. I don't know if any are familiar, but it was 2011 or 2010. North Klamath or Klamath County had a contractor go out to spray for spotted knapweed, and they went into a couple of subdivisions, about 500 homes, and they sprayed with Outpost 22K, which is picloram. It's not designed to be sprayed in there. And the guy went out and he sprayed. He said, "Oh, you can eat this stuff." And of course, a year later, trees were dying. People came to a meeting and they were complaining. The hair was falling out and clumps. Livestock was dying. Pets were dying. And to have a well tested was $300. That was the cost to test for that pesticide. So you hit those situations where the cost of testing is going to be higher than I think is anticipated. And so when it comes to looking at what it needs for funding, I think you need to have your eyes wide open that it could be a lot more. And then there's some other issues, you know, just the common sense stuff of looking how that kind of legislation is written and how it's going to, who it's going to affect. And when we think of rentals out there, we think of people renting a $500,000 or $1 million home, less than we do somebody that is renting, you know, a single wide or double manufactured home. They're rentals, but our concern would be that the money, taxpayer money, should go to help the people that are lower income that are renting, rather than somebody that's renting a $1 million home.
Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League adopted a policy position on water quality way back in 1969. We reviewed it in 77, and after 3 years of study, we completed a water quality and quantity position and study in 2011. In that study, in 2010, there were 3,800 new domestic wells being drilled per year, including 550 in groundwater critical or groundwater limited areas. So the statistics are staggering. And many League members and many Oregonians across the state get their drinking water from wells. So we support 4125, and we appreciate the amendment that works with the landlords so that we can move this bill forward. We support providing a groundwater, safe groundwater fund for low-income and rental property owners to have the ability to protect themselves by installing treatment systems with sideboards, and using grant funds, as mentioned, related to the education part, which would allow local nonprofits, water conservation districts, and OSU Extension to provide local education opportunities is exactly the kind of thing that is needed. Local efforts are often more receptive by our citizens. So rather than take a great deal of your time, we just say, please pass the bill. Great bill should pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Groundwater Association. We are involved in groundwater. Our men and women actually locate the wells. Sometimes we guide our folks through the process. We also construct the wells. My drillers and the pump installers actually equip the wells. And then on top of that, we also represent the water treatment folks who actually treat the wells. I tried to put an X on whether I'm for or against right in the middle. I am kind of ambivalent here. We haven't been involved in this discussion at all, and it's unfortunate because I think there's a lot of things we could have added to this discussion. My previous background, I used to be a county sanitarian at one time, many, many, many moons ago, before I had gray hair, and then worked for the state for disease, waterborne disease outbreaks. I did a lot of investigations on that, so I have a fairly good background on waterborne diseases. Some of the things that we just looked at the bill and said, uh-oh, what's going on here? For instance, what's happening now soon is the federal government is changing their standards on water quality. One of the things that they're doing is dropping standards for total coliform. So my question would be is if we're looking and asking folks to examine for total coliform and there's no standard, what do we do? For public water systems, it's not a problem. They have a follow-up procedure that they have to do. They have redundant procedures that they have to accomplish. A domestic water system, That's not true. So what's happening right now in the water testing lab community is they're trying to decipher how they're going to report when there's no standard. I think it's solvable, but it's going to need a little bit of discussion to figure out how we get through this. The history of testing, one of the I've been around a long time, and when some of these laws were written, we were expecting the fact that if you're testing wells, that there would be easy public access to this information, and that, in fact, the general public would be able to go to these sites and look and see if, in fact, there was issues. For many, many years, all that information and real estate transactions went into a shoebox. It didn't even get into the computer system. In the last few years, of course, it has, and of course, that's why Oregon State was able to do a good job. I'm an Oregon State graduate, so my hat's off to them for doing a great job of trying to locate some of this information. We want to get this information out to the public as well. I mean, it behooves everyone to protect the groundwater and make sure that what we're doing and then the public has access to it. The complexity of players here is quite acute. I mean, we have four and five agencies trying to contribute to each other, and there's a great deal of overlap. Again, I have no position on landlord-tenant stuff. That's between the landlords and the tenants. I think it's a good thing. They should be testing. They should be getting information to their folks. I'd reflect the Central Oregon issue. I was listening to the testimony, and that is the case. There is a lot of issues there in Central Oregon, and he brought up a lot of instances where I do know in the Lapine area there, the groundwater is very close to the top of the surface. And for years, folks would, dig holes and put stovepipe down and actually put a pump in there and drink water. But, you know, the public health implications there is that the public health community would tackle community systems, but they left individuals alone. You could do that if that's how you perceive to do things. However, the issue comes back to is, okay, maybe if that's your choice, that's fine, but the next person coming in ought to know what's going on, and that's part of the reason for some of the testing and everything else. So I won't take up any more of your time. I was here to give credence to some of these issues, but I'm a little bit afraid that there's a lot more complexity here that we haven't tackled. But the landlord-tenant issue, again, I have no position on that. That's between those issues, but I think there's some other things here that really need to be discussed further. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all very much. Next we have Marianne Nash.
Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Marianne Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I want to open by saying that we care greatly about public health and definitely understand the public health concerns that are trying to be addressed by this bill. We were not party to conversations around this bill and didn't know until shortly before session that there were conversations happening around the bill and negotiations being reached. So we were not able to offer our opinion while this is being formed, and would echo the comments of the last speakers that we feel like there are some complexities in this that are not addressed, particularly for agricultural landlords who are in a little bit of a unique position. We have situations often where farmers buy properties that had, you know, maybe one or two buildings, one or two homes on it from pre-existing uses, but they're not being used for employees, they're not being used for farm worker housing, and so they're just being rented out to people that are you know, people in the community that want to live in a rural area, want to live on a farm, often sharing the same groundwater well as the homeowners, or occasionally people that are buying the farm next to them and again, don't need the property, so they rent it out. And it's a vital part of their income, but they're not folks that are accustomed to being landlords, and certainly
I think they understand and take their responsibility to provide safe drinking water carefully, and they take it very seriously. But we're concerned about the costs associated with testing for them, and also the fact that there is a cause of action of the landlord-tenant law. If you've had clean tests, but you're obligated to test every year, if they get busy with harvest or something like that and forget to do the test in a timely manner, they could be subject to cause of action under the landlord-tenant law. We also echo the concerns about the reporting factor to the agencies. We don't think there's enough sideboards on what and how that information is being used, how it's being distributed to the public, what is going on through the education fund with that information. Again, I think it is really important that there is public education around this, that there's such an important public health component to this bill. But we think we really could have benefited from being part of those conversations, particularly because this is largely targeting rural agricultural areas. So with that, I will conclude and say that we also agree that there's some complexities that aren't addressed in this bill that we would like to see addressed before it moves forward. I will say that one of the solutions we offered is part of the Dash 2 amendments, is just exempt exclusive farm use properties and allow us to have further conversations for folks that are on exclusive farm use zones and for farmer landlords and their tenant agreements to make sure that we structure it right for those folks in the future. So with that, I'll conclude and take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? I have a question. If the Dash 2 amendment was adopted, how much of the land in Oregon is exempted?
I don't know, and I don't believe I should have looked up the maps. I do know that largely where folks are farming, that is usually exclusive farm use zones. There's a difference between exclusive farm use and farm use. When people are farming closer into communities, you might get into their zone for farm use, but they're more rural residential type uses. So exclusive farm use is likely the further out places where people are just farming. That's all that they're authorized to do on those exclusive farm use zone lands. And I apologize that I don't have a better answer for the actual acreage that encompasses, but I can definitely get that and follow up with you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So I don't believe we have the paperwork on any of the amendments. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4125 and open a work session on House Bill 4036. So, colleagues, as I sent last night, we do have a Dash 31 amendment that came in late last evening that we are considering today. And Beth, do you want to go over some of the top level changes with the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 31 does a number of things, and I'll just hit some of the highlights. It revises the language that addresses non-consensual takeovers of electric utility service areas, authorizes the Public Utility Commission to open an investigation to determine if an electric company's compliance with the RPS is likely to result in conflicts with or compromises to its obligations to comply with reliability standards. It adds provisions to the community solar program elements that must be adopted and ruled by the PUC. Directs the PUC to require each electric company to implement a community solar program and adopt rules for implementation of such programs on or before July 1st, 2017.
Okay, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. So we are still, as I mentioned, we're still waiting on paperwork for this. I also, in going over, I spent a lot of time with the amendment last night, and I know that the intent was to really capture some of the changes that have been a part of the discussions that have been having at this bill since we started the session. And I think for the most part, it's good. There are a couple of things that I'm concerned about in the amendment. I want to make sure that we get that language right. So we have a couple of days to do that, to continue those discussions. Does anybody have any comments right now, or otherwise my plan is just to carry this over until Thursday and take a look at what we come up with then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me from what I've been hearing, there are a couple of issues that are seemingly quite small and that would bring another big bunch of people to the table if we could adjust those to meet their needs. And wondered if you would consider that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and that's probably part of the conversations that we're having about looking at the tweaks that we can make. I know that, like I said, a lot of work has been done to bring the stakeholders to the table, and I know that some of the issues that were addressed during the public hearings have been brought up, and there's some letters on OLIS to that effect of people who are supporting the bill now.
But I follow up. I've heard just as late as last night from a couple of people and this morning that it isn't quite right yet for them to come to the table. And I'm just wondering what the concerns are about their particular issues.
So I think that when we're looking at the amendments and when I was looking at, you know, how we're going to approach this bill, the base consensus was, you know, trying to stick to the material and to the relevant topics that were in the original bill that came out of the agreement of the utilities and the environmental groups who came in and really try to focus on those as much as possible. Now, obviously, some of the issues that were brought up do touch on other groups. And like I said, for the most part, we've tried hard to do that. I think that, you know, one of the things that I want to do is to, for those things that we're not able to address in this bill this time, is to have an interim work group set up so that we can talk about some of the other issues. And I've already reached out to some of the people who have testified about that intent. So so we'll capture as much as we can, but then...
Yeah, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Colby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to just mention briefly that I do have some concerns around the community solar piece in this, in the Dash 31s, and I'm sure you're aware of some of those. As I've been working with Senator Beyer for a couple of years on community solar and language, and also, you know, a little bit of concern that we got recommendations from the PUC back in October, talking about that we tasked them with House Bill 2941 back last session to come back with some attributes for the design of community solar programs. And so I'm a little bit concerned that a lot of those attributes, you know, are not really part of this proposal. So I'm hoping that we can look at that, and recognizing also Senator Beyer has an opportunity on the Senate side to, you know, weigh in on this as well, but I do have a few concerns about that.
Yeah, thank you. And one thing I will note, I know that there was a Scribner's error in one area of that in terms of the percentage of low income set aside for community solar. So there are a couple things there that we'll need to look at. All right. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4036 and close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.